even some of the people on the Joint Terrorist and Task Force was kind of dismissive of it being other than an accident. And while me and a group of agents had gathered in our supervisor's office and was literally, we had a view of the World Trade Center from there, we saw the second plane. And the fireball, the explosion, everything.
Teacher's like, okay, everybody, all right. Pop quiz time. We're going to do the vocabulary to it. And I just yell out, wait, I got to make my cheat sheet.
I like to joke that I make my living throwing away dead people's sex toys.
I can guarantee you there is nothing you have felt that I haven't felt.
Yeah, and I am a formerly miserable person.
If people don't know how you are, they cannot help you.
Anxiety is the rattling of the lid on the pot of boiling water.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's connected, like me letting go of the past, me not hanging on to my anger, me like trying to become a present being.
You're not in your peak dieting phase now.
I mean, I was only in it for like a quick 6 minutes on a car ride once because there's no, I was in between.
Can we stop for snacks?
Yeah, I was equidistant between two fast food places.
So that if I'm in a situation with like my older daughter and she says something hurtful to me, like you're wearing a lot of statement jewelry right now.
In the very, very niche world of American ghost towning, my dad is a minor celebrity.
Well, we have 50% of the country's in dire poverty, is in homelessness. You know, LA is
50% of the country's in homelessness. That seems like not a correct statistic. Hi there, and welcome to another episode of Sean Conroy Gets Happier. That is the name of this podcast. The reason that is the name of this podcast is because my name is Sean Conroy. And I guess there are other reasons as well. We're releasing this episode on Memorial Day of 2020. It is a catastrophic time in the United States, as probably, I would guess probably the day this comes out, or maybe the day before, the death toll for coronavirus reaches six figures. It was also a catastrophic time this week in the shambolic, tatterdemalion maisonette of isolation here in an undisclosed location high in the Hollywood Hills. And I can explain why. Obviously, my definition of catastrophe is flexible. But one morning earlier this week, I was, as I do every morning, I was making coffee in my French press. I have found that to be my most effective method, the one I enjoy the most for the morning ceremony. And I had my French press sitting on the counter next to my boiling kettle of water. I use an electric kettle. And I went to adjust the French press, the position of the French press. I tried to move it a little bit away from the kettle by slipping my hand between the kettle and the French press. And there wasn't enough room. So my knuckles grazed the boiling kettle, which meant that I jerked my hand away and knocked the French press into the sink, where it broke. Didn't shatter, just a big chunk of it broke off. The glass, you know, it's a glass vessel. So there was a large chunk of French press in my sink, and then a smaller chunk slightly separated from it. Now, you may remember, if you've listened to this podcast for a while, that I had a problem with my sink a while back where there was a clog. And now I anticipated if in fact this French press had broken into several pieces, that there would be glass in the drain, in the, not the trash compactor. What do you call that thing? The thing that grinds up. Anyway, turns out there was no glass in there. And I was able to throw the entire thing in the garbage. But this meant that I had no way to make coffee. And that, as I said, that's catastrophic. So I went to the Ralphs in Studio City, knowing that they sell French presses there. French's presses. French's press? Le France, Le Presse Française. And I walked around the store. I found the aisle where the French presses were. I looked at them for a little bit. They're all the same brand. I don't know why it took me so long to decide, except I saw one of them, one type of press was much larger. And this is a problem I have. I always want to have a couple of cups of coffee and then I want one more. And I end up having to make instant rather than remake. So I was like, what if I get a bigger one? I can, anyway, you see what's going on. Instead of an 8-cup press, I got a 12-cup press. I walked out of the store, I got home, and I realized instead of getting a French press to make coffee, I had bought a cold brew contraption. Not helpful. I didn't want to make cold brew. I wanted to make hot coffee. And of course, you know, I didn't know, like, if it's designed for cold brew, does that mean hot temperatures are going to be a problem? So now I have this cold brew press. We're in the middle of this pandemic. I'm like, I am not going to bring this cold brew press back to the place I bought it because whatever, it was my mistake. I don't want to bring something in from the outside. But, and I know I could have looked it up on the internet. I'm sure there's a YouTube thing that's like, just take 11 paper towels and 2 sheets of toilet paper and boil the grounds in a frying pan, then put it in the oven for 2 minutes, take it out, strain it through the toilet paper, then soak it in the paper towels, then wring out the paper towels, and the coffee is just as good as what you would get in your finest restaurants. But I didn't want to go through all that. So I went back to Ralph's and sought out, once again, the French press area of the store. I mean, luckily this supermarket sells a lot of cooking accoutrement, all kinds of things, and found a French press. Now it was only an 8-cup press, but I was like, this will have to do. This has done. I mean, I think I've had the one that broke for 15 years, so it's okay. I get by. So I took that one and brought it home. Problem solved. Or so I thought until I took the French press out of the box. The new one. The second one I bought in the same day. I opened the box. I undid the cardboard packaging. And inside was a bunch of bubble wrap and a plastic bag filled with shattered glass. It wasn't just a piece or two. The entire thing was a pile of glass splinters. This was how it was when I took it out of the store. So now I have 2 things that I have purchased at the Ralphs in Studio City that are useless to me and are not solving my problem. This time I waited till the next day. I made do. I don't like to go to the supermarket. I don't like to go out at this point more than once every 10 days or 2 weeks. I mean, that's why I started. I'm having food delivered now. I have this Imperfect Foods where they deliver a bunch of vegetables and stuff. And that way I have a lot of vegetables rotting in my fridge over the course of the week. So I waited till the next day. And this time I was like, you know what? I'm 0 for 2. I am going to ask them if they can give me my money back for this. Because at this point, I'm out like $70 for these 2 things. And I'm going to buy another one. So I walk into the Ralphs in Studio City. And turns out, It is store policy and has been for 2 months that there are no returns, period. You cannot return anything, which I am completely on board with. I agree with the manager 100%. When he tells me this, I'm like, I get it. I wonder if I could get a credit because I'm just going to buy another one. And this one is garbage. Like, you're not going to be able to do anything. You couldn't resell it anyway if you gave me my money back. And by the way, I was very careful to keep the receipts. I had the receipts taped to each of the boxes, but I completely understood that given current circumstances, they don't want to take stuff back, not knowing, you know, where it's been. To be fair, it was a long conversation because it was confusing as to was I exchanging one box for the other box? And I had to explain that no, I was exchanging both boxes, but I couldn't exchange them because store policy was against that. And I knew that, but I wanted to get a credit and go and get a third. Anyway, eventually he was very kind and he said, I will credit you for the one that's broken, but I will not take it back. You must take it with you on your way out of the store. And I said, that's absolutely fine. I know there's garbage pails in the parking lot and I will drop it in the parking lot. I can handle throwing it away, but thank you for my refund. So he gave me a credit. I once again found the French press area of the store and realized that all I was seeing was sort of low-rent Cuisinarts, like little food choppers. And I was like, oh no, did somebody come in and buy all 7 of the French presses that were here on the shelves yesterday? And then I realized I was in the wrong aisle. That's how amazing the Ralphs in Studio City is. They have 2 aisles filled with various kitchen appliances you can buy. So anyway, I went to the next aisle. I found a French press. Now I had a cold brew French press, a pile of glass, and a hot brew French press. So I got that one. The exciting thing was I did find a 12-cup French press, a large one. They did have one. So now I was going to be able to make more than the usual amount of coffee. What a, you know, this is like Homeric. But anyway, it was great. When I got up to the cashier, you know, we're all wearing masks at this point, and I was like, I think this might be the same woman who checked me out yesterday. And by check me out, I don't mean she was checking me out, although maybe she was. I don't know what was going through her mind. But she was the woman who ran my items through and had me pay for them. And I was like, I think this might be the same. And I wasn't sure until she said, didn't you just buy one of these yesterday? And I had to defensively say, well, I tried, but it was just a bag of glass, which is a confusing thing to say, granted. So I don't think I cleared anything up for her. But I got the French press home. I then had to adjust the proportions of my, the beans that I grind. Did a poor job of that on the first batch and made tar, basically, because I did look it up on the internet. And boy, that was a mistake. But the second time I got it right. So now I have a large French press, a cold brew French. Well, the cold brew and the bag of glass are still in the trunk of my car for some reason. I don't know why I didn't throw it away on the way, but you never know when you're going to need a bag of glass. So if you want one, let me know. That was my week. My guest today is Stephen Starkweather. As I said, this show will be released on Memorial Day, and it's appropriate that it's Stephen's episode because he is a former officer of the United States Navy, among many other things that you'll hear about on this episode. We don't necessarily specifically get into, is he happy? Why is he happy? Why is he not happy? What does he do to make himself happy? But I think it's there nonetheless in the conversation. I think if you listen, you can hear it, but feel free to decide for yourself. Here it is.
The first question always to somebody who lives in North Carolina is an obvious one, which is Duke or North Carolina.
Well, you know, the thing is, I was raised in New York, mm-hmm. but I was actually born in North Carolina, along with just about my entire family.
Uh-huh.
Born in North Carolina. So I grew up with my family who are from Wilkes County in North Wilkesboro, North Carolina, who they were Duke fans. So I was a Duke fan by proxy. Don't know much about Duke other than knowing a few grads over the years. But, yeah, we just grew up because my mom was very fond of the school, and my dad thought highly of the school. So by proxy, I became a Duke fan, and especially, of course, of their basketball program.
Right. Well, so Duke, which, you know, being a fan of Duke says a lot about a person. So we'll see if that bears out. So we wanted to talk about just the general idea of happiness. And obviously what I'm interested in is, what is your concept of what happiness means in life? And is that a thing that you have been conscious of, been working towards, achieved or not achieved, or are still working towards?
Break it down into certain phases of my life. Very early on, there was a lot of influences in my life, parental as well as others. It took me down a road, Sean, that wasn't really for me.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I was doing some really cool stuff, it wasn't the type of environment or cultures that I really should have been in. And so my happiness was limited in the first part of my adult life. And it's literally been only in the last 15 years or so that I really headed towards things that really were I've been passionate about, or at least found parts of me that really were awoken by true passion, true drive from the inside out. And for me, any sort of definition of happiness, the word passion comes to mind. You find those things in life a lot of times very early in life that you're really passionate about. And I think as you get in toward your teens and adulthood, influences start in your life, you know, whether it's people giving you the great advice, the school counselors, the parents, that these are the things that you should do. And I think a lot of we succumb to that.
Right.
And we end up down roads that really aren't happy roads for us, just to find out way later in life, like I have, that maybe we should have done that all along, but it's never too late to start.
It is never too late to start. And well, I want to get into specifics of both of those things, both the things you did that were not happy and the things you're doing now that have awakened that passion in you. But do you feel like now that you're doing the stuff that maybe you're more passionate about, the other stuff has informed that and made it either informed what you're doing or informed your perception of what you're doing and made you more grateful for it in some way?
Yeah, that's an interesting comment right there. What I've always described my past life, the other life, it was starkly different than what I'm doing right now. I describe that as the texture to the pages of my book of life. They're the things that really added a lot of character, taught me a lot of lessons that I otherwise wouldn't have learned, or taught me lessons that I didn't want to learn, I was resistant to, but had to learn anyway. And it's a really good thing that I did, because I think I have an appreciation for a lot of things that I would have avoided as a young man that I have at least a respect for now. I don't want to necessarily indulge myself in those things right now, but I do have a respect for it instead of being completely dismissive of it. So, yeah, I would say certainly informed and built the sort of character that helped me be, that can help me be a lot more successful in what I'm trying to do right now, which is, as you mentioned at the top of the show, is become an actor that works more and more each year.
Okay, so I want to get into the acting stuff, but before we get into that, let's go back a little bit. And let's start when you are, I don't know, I'm going to pick a random age. Let's say 18. What's going on?
All right, so 18, I'm actually in the U.S. Navy. And let me go back just a little bit. I was really influenced heavily by Dad and certainly my own wishes to go into the military.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to a military high school for my last 2 years of high school called New York Military Academy, which is now extremely famous because
there's another alumnus of that place, right? Isn't there somebody who went there?
Yes, and I can actually tell you a few that aren't known that people might know of but didn't know they graduated yet. But one happens to be the President of the United States.
Right, right.
He's a 1964, Mr. Donald Trump is a 1964 graduate of New York Military Academy.
And I think he was number one in his class in the valedictorian and set all the high jump records and every record while he was there too, right? Isn't that?
Every single one. And his name was on every building.
Right.
At least according to him.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that was a big move. I went from my public high school. I literally, unlike a lot of kids during that era who were being sent to military school to get them out of trouble.
Like him.
I actually approached, yeah, exactly. And I approached my parents and said, hey, I want to be in the military. I want to get a jump start on it. So I graduate there and I go into the Navy. I got accepted into a program that helped develop people for officers training. So it's kind of a prep program to get an ROTC scholarship. And so that you could then
go to college through that.
Exactly. Because okay. I did not qualify to get my scholarship right out of high school.
Right.
And my parents certainly didn't have the money to send me to the school that I wanted to go to.
Mm-hmm.
So 18 years old, I'm there, and I actually graduate from that program, which was probably one of the more difficult, if not the most difficult programs I ever had. It was run by the United States Marine Corps.
I've heard they're tough guys, those Marines.
Yeah, a couple of them. You might find a few of them that are tough, man. But it is one of those things where you're up in the morning at 4:35 o'clock, you're mm-hmm. in a formation at 6 o'clock, and you're studying until about midnight, and that just went on for 9 months or so.
Right.
And I qualified from there to get an ROTC scholarship, and I chose to jump from the frying pan into the fire. And was accepted to go to the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina.
Ah, the Citadel.
So, yeah. So that's where I started my trek, ROTC scholarship, the Citadel, and began to plow through all the craziness that school has to offer. And, of course, more character forged. It's an extremely tough school, considered one of the toughest military schools in the world.
I know the craziness that goes on there. I read The Lords of Discipline, so I know what the Citadel is like.
Just to tell you how much punishment that I loved and the sort of mentality I was at 18 years old, I read The Lords of Discipline the year before I actually went.
And you knew what you were getting yourself into.
I knew what I was getting myself into, mm-hmm. and I was psyched to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very gung-ho, very
right.
patriotic, wanted to do the toughest of the tough and be part of whatever elite group that I could be. I just loved the idea of going off and being a military man for the country.
Right.
And so graduated from there 4 years later and became a naval officer, where I met this crazy guy named Pete Dallamaga.
Not a fan.
You know, that guy had some unbelievable escapades. and fun and craziness and seriousness and all the things that come along with being officers in the Navy. And that was the end of my military time, was after I left there in 1991, if I'm not mistaken.
So how long were you in the Navy for?
4 years.
4 years, okay. And so that means you were at the Citadel before they admitted women.
That's correct.
Because I was at the Citadel after they admitted women. I was not a student there. I performed improv comedy there. And the one thing I remember is that I made one masturbation joke, and I almost brought the house down. It was crazy. But anyway, so you were there for, you were in the Navy for 4 years, and you had served your country, and then, so what happens after that?
Somewhere along the line, is while I'm in the Navy, I developed this crazy dream to become a law enforcement officer of some sort, whether it be state, local, or federal. And
no, I wouldn't say that's a crazy dream, by the way. I think that's, that seems within the realm of possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I was excited about it. You know, when you go back to my earliest days of childhood, I grew up in a little town in New York called Ossining, which is actually most famous for being the home of a notorious prison.
Yes.
Sing Sing. And so I grew up there. Didn't grow up in the worst of circumstances, but certainly didn't grow up in the best of circumstances. Uh-huh. Sing Sing was literally a block and a half from my house. So that was a fixture as a childhood, having one of the most notorious prisons in history about a block and a half away from my apartment where I grew up. And so my neighborhood went from being a very vibrant neighborhood to one that was drug infested in the 1980s, and I saw, and many of my childhood friends get caught up in the drug trade or get caught up in the drug war in some way, and a lot of them ruined their lives, a lot of them lost their lives, and I really can count probably more than two or three dozen of my friends that I lost either to jail or to death during that period right there from the 80s until the 90s. So this was something that I became passionate about. Law enforcement was my way of addressing that. So I wanted to go in there. And at the time, I'm thinking, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to stop these drug dealers.
Right.
So I started applying. You know, I'm in the Navy. I started applying to all the different agencies out there. And the one that showed me the most interest early on and had a process that was open and ready was the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI.
Okay.
And so that was the direction I went. And I became an agent in 1992.
Okay. So again, you were down at Quantico, is that correct?
Correct.
Where the Marines are as well. You couldn't stay away from the Marines.
There was two things about the FBI that was a standard. The FBI loves Marines and they love Citadel graduates.
Uh-huh.
I was in a perfect place.
Right. Perfect. So you become an agent at the FBI, and I guess I'm assuming that means they put you somewhere.
Yeah. As soon as I graduate, is all new agents do. When you graduate from Quantico, you're assigned an office, and they assigned me to Newark, New Jersey's office. In northern New Jersey, one of the finer cities that we have in America, certainly at that time, and perfect if you are in law enforcement because you're going to actually see a lot very early.
Well, at least so there's a convenient airport if you like Continental Airlines. That's that's a Continental hub.
Yeah, it was right there. A taxi ride was only about $10.
Yeah, so Newark, a bit of a rough place.
Yeah, at the time, Newark was always fighting with its other New Jersey city, Camden, New Jersey, for who was number one in the crime rate in the country at that time. This was the early 90s. So the crimes were drugs, carjacking, gangs, a lot of violent crime in that city at the time.
And how are you involved in that? I guess that's, you know, it's interesting. We're hearing a lot about the FBI right at this moment. And there was, I saw a photo on the news. I don't know if it was last night or this morning, or I don't know when it was, because the news is on in my apartment all the time. But it was somebody talking about this report that came out about the IG the IG's report about the FBI and their handling of all this stuff. But the point that one of the news commentators was making was they showed this photo of a shootout in New Jersey where I think six people were killed, one of them a law enforcement agent, and they showed a picture of somebody in a, I guess, a bulletproof vest holding a long gun, and the label on the vest said FBI, and this person was, you know, I think I would assume part of the perimeter while this gun battle was going on. And the guy was making the point that people don't really know what the FBI does, but this is one of the things they do. They are involved in this type of thing. So what kinds of things, just because I have no idea, were you responsible for doing while you were there?
You know, Newark was an interesting office, and I will tell you, the FBI, the responsibilities of an average agent will change drastically from one office to the next, mm-hmm. because crime is regionalized, just like so many other things. You know, you go to Los Angeles back in those days, gangs were probably the number one thing that the FBI was involved in,
right?
Other than the larger crimes that the FBI has traditionally done. The FBI's mission traditionally has always been going after larger groups or larger impact crimes. White-collar crime is almost an exclusive domain for the FBI because the FBI's budget and manpower can lend to having large and long-term investigations.
Mm-hmm.
And so most law enforcement agencies, whether state or local, simply do not have the budget to handle 2 and 3 year investigations and dedicate 10, 12, up to 20 agents exclusively for an investigation, whereas the FBI has the manpower and the budget to do something like that.
Right. So we all saw that. We all saw that in The Wire when McNulty kept going to his friend at the FBI and saying, "You got to help me out. We don't have the money to do this. You got to help me out." And then the FBI guy was like, "No, we're all focused on terrorism now, so I can't help you."
Yeah, and you know, things like that happen. But in the early 90s in Newark, the city started to have such a problem with gangs, drug dealing, and carjacking that the FBI literally had to dedicate squads to form task forces, which are made up of state, local, and the federal agents, of course, to address that. Mm-hmm. Because some of those gangs began to get very sophisticated at the time. Technology began to change at that period right there. So it was very hard for the locals to keep up and do their normal patrol duties,
right,
and the normal duties that they do to protect the city. So they'll ask for the FBI to get involved. Also, you know, on the other side of it, the practical side, the FBI in the 90s was coming out of the Cold War, which they had a lot of counterintelligence agents dedicated for 20 or 30 years. And so the Cold War is coming to an end, and people started to ask the question, so what exactly are you going to do with all those agents that was working counterintelligence,
right,
and doing spy work all this time? Well, the FBI's got to go out there and find something to get its nose into so that they can start getting congressional funding and increase their budget to help out. So on the practical side, I would say the FBI certainly will jump in the middle of things sometimes because it's practical for them to do so when something, there is a significant, I would say, cultural shift or international shift, like when the Berlin Wall came down.
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI is now, honestly, looking for something to do.
Right.
Because think about it. All these federal agents balloon and ask for budget dollars for crimes of the day. Like, terrorism is it right now. And Congress will say absolutely, and you know how it goes with the politics.
Not well. Not well, Steve. It doesn't go well from what I can see.
And I'm going to agree with you 100% because we don't know when to start and we don't know when to stop. I had transferred about 2 years earlier to the New York office, Joint Terrorism Task Force, and had the distinction of actually being there on 9/11. The federal building, the FBI federal building, is about four blocks diagonally over from the former site of the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first indication I knew that day that something was going on was agents kind of scrambling around the office, and I started asking people what was going on, and they said a plane just hit the World Trade Center.
Right. Everybody thought it was maybe an accident. Maybe it was a small plane. We didn't know what was going on.
That's exactly right. I mean, even some of the people on the Joint Terrorism Task Force was kind of dismissive of it being other than an accident. And while me and a group of agents had gathered in our supervisor's office and was literally, we had a view of the World Trade Center from there, we saw the second plane. And the fireball, the explosion, everything.
Now, let me ask you this. I have a question, because I know that there were people for a while before that happened saying that it was going to happen. Were there people like that at the FBI?
Yeah, I'm going to raise my hand on that one. I was one of them.
Okay.
For years, I was saying, and I was at least in the ballpark of the type of mindset and the fundamentalist followings that these people would have. Mm-hmm. That would do something like that. I was pretty accurate on that. But probably the most famous guy is a guy named John O'Neill, who was my boss. He was the special agent in charge of the National Security Division of New York office, who, when I got there, he was one of the few people who was sounding the alarm. He was loud and clear that, guys, we're in trouble. We don't recognize the trouble that we're in. And it's going to come. It's just a matter of when.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was one of the unfortunate casualties of that day.
Right.
He had left the FBI over, ended his career over some, I would say, political shit that had
some bullshit
happened there.
Mm-hmm.
Bullshit. You know, something to do with classified information that he left in a goddamn hotel somewhere. And he retired and was actually working at the World Trade Center as the head of the security for the World Trade Center on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the people that actually went back into the building to help, and he never came out.
Right. So there were, and again, you know, it was a horrible tragedy, but that, I'm guessing, probably was also frustrating in some ways, that here were these people talking about this and knowing about it, and then nothing was really done.
Yeah, there was deaf ears all over the FBI headquarters, others within the New York office, who, you know, was one of the cities with the distinction of having a terrorist attack in the city back in 93. And there was a very small group of agents between New Jersey's task force and New York task force that was trying to sound the alarm. I was at least lucky enough to have written it down and sent stuff to headquarters during the 97, 98 timeframe, asking the hard questions. And the answers that I got back were just amazingly bureaucratic and full of shit. And so I realized that our headquarters really had their head up their ass on the subject of terrorism. They had no idea what the fuck was about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so me and an analyst over in New Jersey tried to piece it together ourselves. And, you know, you can imagine you got two agents basically sitting over in New Jersey, agent and analyst, trying to piece something like that together, very sophisticated, very large,
mm-hmm.
with very little support from headquarters.
Right.
New York, at least, was aggressive on the subject of terrorism. They had entire squads dedicated to different terrorist groups because that office, just to give you a perspective, the New York office has probably now something like 1,300 or 1,400 agents in that one office alone.
Right.
New Jersey has something, Newark had maybe 400 or 500.
Yeah.
And so not enough manpower to go around certainly to address a subject or a threat that was that massive, and certainly it could be as sophisticated as anything technology-wise that we had. And so it was a tough and frustrating period. I learned an enormous amount. And the sort of satisfaction you get from saying, I told you so, it really dissipates when 3,000 people.
Yeah, of course.
I said, listen, when this goes down, this was literally about 2 weeks before 9/11. I said, when this goes down, I'm probably going to stick around a little while to see what the reaction of the FBI is. But if I see business as usual, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm handing it in and I'm walking. And that's what happened.
Right.
In July of 2002, I was done.
Right. Now, I've heard the saying, never leave a job unless you have another job lined up. So did you have another job lined up?
I did. I was recruited to work for this crazy guy down in Washington who was running a research organization and / think tank down there, the investigative project for terrorism.
Yeah, I mean, I would guess coming out of the FBI, that's like kind of an impressive credential to have if you're looking for a job. Like for me, my credentials are like I can type 15 words per minute and I'm slightly familiar with Windows 95. But you coming out of the FBI, that seems like that plays much better in a resume.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was good, especially going to Washington, D.C. after a historic attack on the United States.
Right.
So people wanted to know what I knew, and I certainly wanted to get to a point where I could actually make a difference, because sitting in a cubicle in the FBI on a terrorism task force did not give me that.
It sounds like it should, but it didn't.
Exactly.
Which makes it all the more frustrating. Like, you're right in the... This is not a term I would ordinarily use, but you're right in the belly of the beast, and yet there's nothing, you know, it's still so frustrating.
Yeah. And I got into the FBI at a fairly young age. I was in my late 20s. And so I had been there for 10 years, and I still had 13 years to go before I could even look at retirement.
Right.
So I knew that was going to be a very, very difficult 13 years. I could see it. It was just going to be more than I could bear, because the 10 years was kind of frustrating too.
Yeah.
And so unless the Bureau was going to turn on a dime, I mean, within a year, which I saw no sign of it, then I was going to be literally just depressed by the time I left.
Now, this is an interesting, I'm interested in this because it feels like that's a decision most people would not make, to go, like,
that's right.
You have so much sunk cost at that point of like, well, I put in 10 years, I just have to do 13 more and then I can retire and I'll still be, I mean, you would still be in your early 40s at that time, right? by the time you were able to retire?
I would have been actually 50. You know, when I would have been eligible.
Okay, but still not, you know, not ready for the retirement home. You just would have been retired.
Right.
But
and, you know, they allow you to go to 30 years. You know, I certainly had that option.
Right.
Because of how early I got in there.
But I guess I'm saying, was it a difficult decision to say, you know what, I'm out? Or were you totally comfortable?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say difficult. I think when you get frustrated to that degree at anything, you've got to make a change.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I had a choice because my frustration level had just taken me literally off the deep end as far as my respect for the organization, respect for a lot of my superiors. I began to really behave in ways that I had not as an FBI agent. I began to go and simply dismiss directives from my superiors and go out and do the shit that I thought should have been done versus the shit that they were telling me to do. And I couldn't take it anymore. And I started to get in trouble. I started to get called into the supervisor's office and in higher up's office, and people were mad at me, and I just didn't give a shit. And I realized, as just a mature adult at the time, that, you know what? You know, the FBI isn't going to change, so you're going to have to be the one to make this change. So, you know, I would say yes, in certain circumstances it would have been difficult, but when you are sunk to those depths right there,
mm-hmm.
it's a mandate. You don't have, honestly, you don't have a choice. And if you stick around, you are glutton for more punishment.
It's just going to get worse.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe a mind-altering experience. I mean, because you get depressed. You get to the point where you just can't take it anymore. And yet, your statement is right on. Most people that were literally sitting there with me, as angry and frustrated, most of those guys stayed in. And all accounts that I heard over the years, they were miserable as hell all the way to the end.
And, you know, it just would have led to more and more of the, I don't know what they call them, the agent in charge going, Starkweather, in my office. Look, I'm sick of you playing by your own rules. You know, that,
that exactly. I mean,
action movie trope.
More and more worse. We had an inspection coming up, and these guys were like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You're not filling out your paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
And I was spending my time literally working on other task forces that were startled by 9/11 and wanted to do something.
Right.
I was literally gathering my own coalition, which, you know, they call that being a rogue agent. So I was in the bad boy chair for my last probably 8 or 9 months in the FBI.
Right. So let me ask you this, a couple more things I want to get to, but tell me what led you to the acting thing. You've said that you're now working as an actor, working more and more every year. How did you get to that point?
Wow. Yeah. So it's actually a very recent event where I actually started acting, but the story starts right after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is where Stephen Starkweather and Sean Conroy actually have another degree of separation.
Oh boy.
So yeah. I mean, check this out. So we know Pete.
Right.
Right. So I'm an agent in New York. This is December of 2001, so fresh, 9/11's fresh and still horrible.
Uh-huh.
New York. So I start talking to this lady. And we've been talking for 18 years now.
Wow.
Almost to the day.
You must be out of breath.
And yeah, we haven't stopped, I swear. So here's where Sean Conroy comes in.
Oh, boy.
She is an actress in New York City.
Uh-huh.
And I'm listening to her. We're talking. We're dating. And she takes this improv class with the Upright Citizens Brigade.
I've heard of that place. Yeah.
I think you have. And she started telling me about this instructor named Sean Conroy.
I've heard about that guy.
I think you know him well. And it was, you know, didn't think much of it at the time. And she isn't acting. We decide we're going to get married. We get married.
Still talking.
September. Yeah, talking the entire way. Didn't miss a beat. September of 2002, I'm out of the FBI. I'm married. And I'm heading down to Washington to take my new job. And this actress, because New York City was so difficult to get in and out of, was glad to get out of New York City because acting had dried up. And she was going to start her new life with this dashingly handsome former FBI agent. And we began our trek, new life, man. But Tracy Gardner was taking her class.
Holy shit.
When we met.
That's amazing.
I know it.
Small world. And so you're together with this actress, and you're like, if she can do it, I can do it. Or how did that come about?
Well, I started because I was actually advised at one point by friends of mine, not in an absolute professional setting, but friends of mine that had a counseling background, and said, hey, Steve, you really need to, the whole trade center thing really screwed me up pretty good. Mm-hmm. The whole FBI experience, I was literally having to fight off a lot of things.
Right.
And so some friends of mine said, Steve, talk to people about it. Try to find an endeavor out there that could, help you develop another side of your brain. Because I was very left brain, as most FBI agents are. And I started to write. And so I started exploring creative writing and began to utilize just an artistic side of me that I didn't even know was there. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. And the whole time, Tracy's nudging me, going, I think you can act, Steve. I really think you should try acting. But I was never in a school play, Sean. Not anything. I mean, not anything my entire life. I had not been in any sort of performing art or any sort of artistic or creative endeavor in my life.
Officer in the Navy, so, FBI agent, never any acting experience.
That's right. And so we're married. You go down to Washington. This guy I'm working for down there, this organization, the Investigative Project for Terrorism, sticks me on TV. They put me on Fox News, NBC. I'm on literally program after program for 2002, 2003, and I think 2004. I'm doing radio interviews. I'm doing all this stuff. But I'm being myself, and I never counted that as any sort of performance. So and my camera presence was absolutely awful because the light would come on, and I'm staring at in my mind, 5 billion people on Fox News across the entire globe.
They get great ratings on that network. They get really great ratings, I've heard.
That's exactly right, because it is great entertainment over there. And I thought, wow, you really suck at this. Just stick to writing. And I did that for a while. And then in 2005, I had my first kid. And then 2007, we had number two. So my focus shifted, of course, to my boys.
Right.
And as we began to go, I get into the firearms industry of all places. And I start getting into the management and executive management side of the firearms. And I start moving my way up kind of a corporate ladder in different firearms companies. And kind of left that stuff behind a little bit, still kept up with the writing, but that was it. I was going to do that. And about 3 years ago, actually a little more than 3 years ago, I was teaching the actors at my wife's agency here in Asheville how to present themselves with firearms without looking like the dope you see on TV all the time.
Drives me crazy, so, Steve. It drives me crazy when I see a person on TV who's supposed to be an experienced officer of the law who does not know how to hold a weapon correctly.
Or put on the right persona or move with a firearm.
Cover the room.
Oh, God. Drives me insane. And so here's my chance to make a difference finally. Right?
This is your chance.
So Tracy puts together this class with the actors of her agency. It was a good turnout. I'm there teaching, and her agent is listening on the other side of these curtains where the classroom was. And at the end of the class, he comes out, and he's whispering to her, he's pointing at me, and he goes, "Hey, man." He didn't know me, so he's like kind of hesitant to approach me. I could be an intimidating guy when I'm in my gun mode. Yeah. And she comes over and says, "John wants to talk to you." So I go over there, and he goes, "Look, man, I want to see you in front of the camera." And I go, he says, no. Here's a script. She'll show you what to do. And he wanted to do a screen test just to see how I came across.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy sat me down, said, "Okay, here's your script. Here's how to look at this. Here's a few beats. These are things that you want to react to."
She used some of the notes I gave her in class, I'm sure.
I think she did. I think it actually said upright citizens. So I'm getting ready to do the screen test, and something happened. I absolutely loved the process.
Wow.
Getting ready for the character was so much more exciting to me than actually getting in front of the camera and doing it.
Yeah.
And something clicked right there.
That's interesting.
It was a moment. It was one of those life-altering moments for me, mm-hmm. because I said to Tracy, I said, "You know what, there's an enjoyment here that I don't remember the last time I felt this." And
she was like, "Thanks a lot. I just had dinner with you."
I know it, man. And I go to do the screen test, and I say, "Hey, I think I want to start taking some classes." And so the agent does classes at the co-op, and he taught a whole myriad of classes from the very beginning audition class all the way through script analysis, improv, all these classes that I took.
How to accept an award.
Yes, how to walk across the red carpet without mm-hmm. looking like an ass. Exciting shit.
Yeah.
And so I started taking these classes, and the more I learned about the art of acting and allowing a character to inhabit you and actually being, you know, really given a convincing and believable acting performance, I really just, it completely put me. And so 3 years ago, I started taking the classes. He started submitting my name for auditions. I started getting auditions, and I started actually getting cast, mm-hmm. which was a shocker for me, because honestly, if I didn't get cast, I think I'd still be trying to act because I just love doing it.
Yeah.
And it just kept going from there, and now I've been cast in, you know, several things, and I'm a SAG-eligible actor at this point.
That's great. And to go back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, it feels like all of the stuff that you went through was necessary for you to get to the point where this particular thing happened, that you were able to find the thing that you enjoyed. In other words, had you not been in the Navy, had you not been in the FBI, had not those things led you to this think tank and from that think tank into the firearms industry, you would not have been teaching this acting workshop about firearms, which led to the agent seeing you and saying, "Let's do something." And now here you are.
There are no accidents.
Yeah.
You're right. There's no accidents, man. And that did. It was in this huge way. The way I describe it to people is that so many of the opportunities that I got in my life, I really sought them out, and I really did. Like, my personality's always been a determined, aggressively going after my goals. time I was actually leaning against the door of this opportunity, someone opened it, not knowing I was there. I fell into the room of this opportunity, looked around and said, hey, I kind of like this place. I think I'm going to stay. And that's the best way I can describe how I became an actor.
And now you are in the room where it happens. That's an acting reference.
There you have it. Stephen Starkweather has been on quite a journey. And I think that I can certainly relate to that, that I have tried to figure out what are the things that I really want to do. He has found some of that himself. And I think that's something we can all... I don't know. I don't know if you can relate to it. I can relate to it. That's all I care about. Follow me on Twitter, at Sean Conroy. The executive producer of Sean Conroy Gets Happier is Lauren Dunitz. Our imperfect produce is Pete Gallimaga. Crazy guy named Pete Gallimaga. Special thanks to Stephen Starkweather. The show was recorded at All Things Comedy Studios in Burbank, California. Our sound engineer is Aaron Brungart, who is also our firearms consultant. He runs our terrorism think tank, and he refuses any cup of coffee not made in a 32-cup Belgian press. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Wash your hands. I can't imagine that anybody who listens to this show is not wearing a mask, but if so, put one on when you're around people. And, I hope you get happier. We'll see you next time. Thanks.